Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Doris Kearns Goodwin is one of America's most beloved historians. Her new book is An Unfinished Love Story, a personal history of the 1960s. In it, she takes us along on the emotional journey she and her husband, Dick Goodwin, embarked upon in the last years of his life, as the couple examined a tumultuous decade in American history through the lens of their own personal involvement in public service. This is part one of a two-part interview. I spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin before a sold-out audience at a Northshire Bookstore event held at Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, New York.
Give us a sketch of how this project came about with you and your husband, Dick, going through this. How many boxes total?
300 boxes schlepped around with us for 42 years. Crazy.
And like somewhat curated, but not really. What was the idea, the initial thought of let's do this today?
What happened is my husband had turned 80, and one day he came down the steps singing from Oklahoma, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." And I said to him, "What's going on?" He said, "I finally decided it's time to open the boxes." And I had looked in them enough to know that there was great stuff in there. As an historian, he had saved everything. I mean, every draft of every speech, every memo to the presidents, every letter, journal, diary from the 60s. And he was sort of everywhere in the 60s. He worked for JFK in the White House. He did projects with Jackie. He was with LBJ in the heyday of the Great Society. He then turned against the war, was with McCarthy in New Hampshire in the primary, and then was in Bobby's campaign. And with Bobby when he died, he's at the Democratic Convention. He's sort of like Zelig. He's everywhere you want somebody to be. But interestingly about chronology, because the decade had ended so sadly, with Bobby killed and Martin Luther King killed and the riots in the streets and the campus violence, it was so sad that he didn't want to look backward. He just wanted to go forward. And finally, as he turned 80, this is the way he talked. "Well, I've just decided if I have any wisdom to dispense, I better start dispensing now." Who talks that way, right? So anyway, we made a pact that we would go through every weekend. We'd work on boxes, and we would start chronologically. So we would pretend that we didn't know what happened later, so we could just exhilarate in the early 60s before everything happened and how exciting a decade it was and all the progress that was made, and then relive it and see how we felt about it as we went along.
You say that you basically wanted to start with a clean slate because, I'm probably simplifying this, but he was a Kennedy guy, you were a Johnson guy.
It was a big deal. I mean, it sounds crazy, but we did argue about it all of our married life. I mean, he was so loyal to the Kennedys. He was young when he started working for Jack Kennedy. He's in his 20s still. As I said, he was close to Jackie and then really, really close to Bobby. So he felt that that was his world. And there was a difference in the Kennedy world, even though his best work was done with LBJ, because, you know, the war he had turned against LBJ, they had broken with each other. There was a real sadness and resentment to it. So he comes into this as a Kennedy person. I was so loyal to LBJ because my work with him when I was first a White House fellow and then on his White House staff and then helped him on his memoirs in the last years of his life, those conversations with LBJ were what made me into a presidential historian, and I felt so loyal to LBJ and his family. So we would constantly argue about, I would say, you know, Kennedy's bills never got through. It was LBJ who got every one of them through. And he'd say, "Yeah, but maybe the war might not have gone in the same direction if it hadn't been for LBJ." And it wasn't a fun argument. I mean, it sounds funny now when we talk about it, but we were a little nervous as we went through the boxes that would make it exacerbated. But it did just the opposite. I relived the Kennedy inspiration. He relived the great time with LBJ. And it softened him in those last years before he died. And it meant a lot to him to let those grievances about LBJ go. And remember, one night he said, "Oh my God, I'm feeling affection for the old guy again. How can this happen?" But I was so glad when that happened.
Before Dick goes to work for Kennedy, he's in D.C., and probably the first high-profile event is the quiz show scandals.
Yeah.
In fact, the movie Quiz Show is based on the history that he wrote.
Right, and it was an interesting situation because what happened is he graduated from Harvard Law School as first in his class and as the editor of the Law Review and could have gone anywhere. They were flying him around the country to whatever law firm he wanted to go to, but somehow that never was what he wanted. He wanted something different. He wasn't quite sure what it was. In fact, he wrote a series of letters to his best friend from Tufts, and those letters are fabulous. I've always wanted to know what he was like as a young man. I kept telling him, what were you like as young, because he was 12 years older than me. And he said, tell me what you were like. He said, how do I know what I was like then? I was too busy being me to tell you what I was like. But I found out what he was like when I read these letters. One batch of letters, just before we get to the quiz show, had to do with the fact that when he was, as I say, this in Law Review editor, he was being flown around the country like an athlete. Which law firm would you like to go to? Do you want a stipend here, or do you want a clerk for a justice? And that's eventually what he did, clerk for Justice Frankfurter. The next day, I found this picture of the Law Review in his papers, and I was so mad when I saw it. There were 60 guys and two women. One was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she couldn't even get an interview for a job. She's on that same Law Review as all these other guys, and it just was so maddening. And of course, it wasn't his fault, but I went in there, this isn't fair. How did this not happen? But anyway, he chose to work for Justice Frankfurter, and then afterwards, he got a job with the House Commerce Committee that was studying communications. And he's the one who discovered that the questions were being given. Some of you may remember the quiz shows, the $64,000 question and 21, where people would stand in isolation booths, and they seemed so brilliant. They were asked these questions, and they could answer them so amazingly. It turned out it was all corrupt. They were given the questions ahead of time and prepared the answers. And he's the one who discovered that, and then it became the movie that Robert Redford directed, a really wonderful movie. He was played by Rob Morrow, who had been on Northern Exposure, and he came to our house for a couple weeks to get my husband's characteristics. And my kids were then in high school. They were so excited that all the girls were there running around for... But anyway, at the end of the movie, Redford said to Dick, what did you think when we went to the premiere? He said, how could I not love it? I'm played by a handsome young guy. I'm young again. I'm the moral center of the movie. And I get the best last line. The last line of the movie was this incredible thing. They investigate. They show that it's corrupt. But in the end, the advertisers and the producers, they all stay the same. It's just the candidates that get hurt. And he said, I thought we was going to get television, but television's going to get us. And that may be true today.
So Dick's working with Justice Felix Frankfurter, and then he becomes involved in part of the Kennedy orbit.
Yeah, what happens is, and he didn't quite realize it at the time, while he was working for Justice Frankfurter, who he adored, and Frankfurter had no children, so his clerks became like his sons. While he was working for him, he got a call from Ted Sorensen, the chief speechwriter for JFK, and said, would you like to try your hand at a speech for him? He's still senator, but they knew he would be running for president. And so he did try his hand at it. And then they asked him to do a second one and then a third one. He had no idea that it was part of a contest that 30 other people had been asked to do the same thing. And they were going to pick a second speechwriter. And he won the contest, as he said. And as he looked at it, it wasn't very good, he didn't think. He said, well, it didn't matter. It got me the job. And it was kind of dramatic. You know, they can imagine a young person writing a speech, you know, these dramatic phrases. Anyway, so he was on the plane then with JFK, this Caroline prop plane that JFK's father had gotten for him so that he could travel the country in his own plane. But it meant that there was real intimacy in that group of campaigning people. There were two chairs that became beds for Ted and Dick. JFK had his own headquarters in the back. They had, you know, typewriters there. They had, you know, communications devices. And they would travel the entire time together. So there was an intimacy, and I can see why he romanticized that trip. And he saw JFK at his best in some ways. He was a candidate who at the beginning couldn't speak very well. It's hard to imagine this, but the reporter said he spoke so fast, like I do, that he didn't wait for people to absorb what he was saying. But he always would ask the reporters, where did I lose them? Where did I keep them? He learned as he went along. So I watched JFK grow, and I began to feel a feeling for him, especially when there's that moment when the Peace Corps is born, which is one of my favorite stories that Dick tells.
You get the sense of this throughout the book that Dick and JFK, and even when he's working with Johnson in the early years, that they're all on the same page.
There really was a sense in that campaign, and I must say I began to feel it again going through this ordinary material, that a new decade was being born and that it was going to be a time when people could make a difference. And they felt that. I really think they felt that. And the perfect example of it, which is what Joe and I were talking about, is that on October 14th in 1960, Kennedy's going to Michigan just to for a whistle-stop tour, and he stops at the University of Michigan to simply sleep in the Union that night to get up early the next morning. But when he gets there at 2 a.m., his plane was delayed. 10,000 kids from the University of Michigan had been waiting for him for 5 hours. So Dick and Ted immediately run off. They know he's going to have to make some remarks. They hadn't prepared anything for him. It was too late. They run off to the all-night cafeteria. They were so hungry. So they missed what really important happens. He starts going up the stairs, and then he turns around, and he says to himself, I better say something to these kids. They've been waiting so long. And all he does is to ask them, would you be willing to give 2 years of your life and go to Ghana and help the people there? If you're going to be an engineer, you're going to be a teacher, would you be willing to share your skills with people in underdeveloped countries? And the kids responded immediately to those questions. And then he left, and that was it. And then there was no mention of the Peace Corps. That's all that happened. And then the next day, the kids themselves, two graduate students, led the march, who I interviewed later. They were in their 80s, and I found them. It was so exciting to find them again. And we talked about it all, and all the memories came out, and they had kept all sorts of journals themselves. They set forth a petition, and they got 1,000 students to sign the petition saying they would give 2 or 3 years of their life to this non-existent program to help people in other lands. And when that word reached Dick and Ted, they were still on the campaign trail, they then had those group of kids come and present the petition to JFK, and then they proposed the Peace Corps. They thought, well, if the kids are serious, then we better be serious about it too. Nixon immediately took after it and said it was Kitty Gate or something, and it was, you know, just a way to avoid the draft, but it turned out to be the signature program of the Kennedy administration. And it was part of that moment that I think the 60s would have in those early days, mostly sparked by the civil rights movement, that ordinary people could make a difference. And if they got together, there was nothing that could prevent them from doing something and having a positive impact on life. And that was the feeling of being young. I mean, I felt it too. I was young then too. But any of us who grew up in that time, I think, and there looks like there may be some people here who are my age. It feels so good to be among you all.
And this is the germ of ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I mean, that's the germ of it.
That's exactly right. And we were in a Cold War. I mean, that's very much a part of the whole campaign. And the reason why this understanding of a Peace Corps mattered was that it would show that a free world had this capacity to do something, to serve better than a communist world. And that would be the way we could win the hearts and minds of all these countries in Africa that were still up for grabs. Which way would they go, communism or the free world?
You write in a stuffed box labeled JFK 1961 Memos and Speeches, my eye fell upon a folder that read, Areas of Responsibility of the Counselors. There, under Dick's name, four primary areas were listed: foreign affairs, Latin America, foreign aid, and civil rights. The focus of foreign policy seemed odd, since most of Dick's former work had concerned domestic issues. And that's not a white list.
No, I know, it's crazy. There's a very much smaller White House staff than later we came to know. So the idea that he would be in charge of Latin America simply because in the campaign they needed a speech on Latin America. Ted Sorensen was involved with a more important speech on I think it was going to be on religion that was going to be in Houston. So Dick writes this Latin American speech. He proposes himself. He comes up with the idea for an Alliance for Progress, mainly because there was a magazine right next to him, Alianza, so he called it, that's how he got the idea for the Alliance. And he was going to call it Alliance for Development, but he called a friend of his who knew Latin America, and he asked how that was spoken in Spanish, and it was a more complicated word, and Kennedy could never speak Spanish, nor could Dick. He had had a Berlitz course. Neither one of them knew anything about Latin America, but anyway, comes this program, so he's in charge of that program, and that he becomes the Latin American man. That could never happen today. It's much more bureaucratic. But the civil rights thing came about again because of a speech. He was going to give a big speech in Los Angeles on civil rights, the first major speech that Kennedy was going to give, and Dick was assigned that speech. And he was so excited because so many of the rest of the speeches were stump speeches. You know, I'll put a dam here, I'll put a river project here, I'll do this, I'll put coal in West Virginia, but this was on civil rights. So he had spent so much time working on the speech. And then he gets to the thing, he's standing in the back of the hall, there's 1,000 people there, and Kennedy just started talking extemporaneously and very funnily about the difference in the campaign slogans between Republicans and Democrats. You know, the keep cool with Coolidge or stand pat with McKinley versus the New Deal, the Fair Deal, and he was making forward movement for the Dem. He doesn't even mention Dick's speech. Finally, he pulls it out at the very end. And in it, there was a promise to end discrimination in federal housing and by an executive order. That was the important part of it. And he mentions that. And then it's all over. And then the next day in the newspaper, they say he's much better with extemporaneous speaking than he is with a speech. But Kennedy went up to him and said, "Good speech, Dick." And Dick said, "Both speeches, Mr. President." But then, Mr. Candidate. But then what happens is later, they're going through the 87 speeches that he promises that he made during the campaign. And Kennedy comes upon this promise to end federal discrimination in housing with the executive order. He said, "Who the hell wrote that?" And Sorensen says, "I didn't write it." And then Dick just said, "It's the only time I never took credit for writing a speech." He didn't say a word. But anyway, it became a problem then because it was very controversial. The real estate company didn't want it. The housing authorities didn't want it. And he delayed it. Kennedy delayed it and delayed it. Dick was so disappointed. And then I pointed to him. "He disappointed you, you see. Johnson finally got this through." He did. He got a federal housing bill through. Anyway, he finally did deliver it.
So two points about that. First of all, so Sorensen says he doesn't write it. And then Dick doesn't say anything. And then JFK said, "Well, I guess nobody wrote it."
Oh, right. He remembers my book better than I do, right? That was the important punchline. JFK said, "Well, I guess nobody wrote it," right? Exactly.
But that is also what we hear this now a lot with the stroke of a pen.
Right. With a stroke of a pen. Executive orders are always fairly controversial. I mean, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was an executive order, and we're hearing a lot about executive orders, and here was one. And that was part of the problem, that executive orders don't have the power from one administration to another. That's why Johnson finally got a federal housing bill through in 1968 after Martin Luther King died. He wanted a law, because a law has presumably more permanency, although they get taken back too.
You write not only about the relationship of Dick and President Kennedy, but also with Jackie. And do you have a sense of what the basis of that friendship and trust that came rather quickly?
It's an interesting question, Joe, and I'm not sure I fully understand it. I think part of it was that, I mean, Jackie really loved reading, and she was very smart. And Dick and she got along well. They talked about projects together. In fact, it was Dick's idea. We found a memo again in the boxes where he said to Jackie, "How about a dinner for the Nobel Prize winners?" And it turned out to be the dinner that is later called the Dinner in Camelot. A whole book has been written about it. Pulitzer Prize winners and Nobel Prize winners were together, and it was a glittering night when one Nobel Prize winner who'd never met another one meets each other, and same thing with Pulitzer Prize winners, and the whole thing was beautifully choreographed, lots of drinking, lots of good food. That's when Kennedy said, as he introduced everybody, "This is a night when more talent has been assembled in the White House than any other time since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." So he was able to do that, right? But anyway, because it was Dick's idea, he was able to escort Jackie to the dinner. And we've had this picture in our house for this whole time of him looking so proud as she's beautifully right by his side and they're going to the dinner. And underneath it, she'd sent it back to him later with, you know, was it, she'd used some line from, she knew poetry, she knew drama, she knew Shakespeare. It was really a sad look back at, could this really have happened, that this happened and it was all gone afterwards. So he helped her to get the money that was needed to save the Egyptian monuments from the Aswan Dam, which was being developed in Egypt, that was going to flood a lot of Egyptian monuments. And in return for mobilizing the money from the philanthropic world and from the Congress, he and Jackie got to have a scrapbook of temples that they could bring back in return for that. And he brought back the Temple of Dendur, which is at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York now. So that was a project they worked on together. And then much later, I realized I found a letter from Jackie, a handwritten letter in 1966, of course, after Kennedy had died. She was traveling around the world trying to figure out where she could live without the memories of everything that was still stalking her of the assassination. She had tried Brazil, she tried Argentina, and now she was in Hawaii. And she wrote this beautiful handwritten letter. She was taking Chinese brush lessons, and it had all the paintings on it. And she talked about all the people who had tried to find solace in Hawaii, Jack London and various writers, and maybe she could find it there and she could live day by day. Maybe she would go to the Eastern philosophy and just sort of not even think about the world. But then she said to Dick, "I'm not sure about this, but you'll understand this because you're a troubled soul as I am." And then I looked at him, I said, "Really, you must have known her much better than I thought. You've got a lot to tell me, kid." So anyway, they were very good friends.
President Kennedy, we're going to 1963. President Kennedy hasn't done all he could in the area of civil rights. Martin Luther King Jr. was quoted in newspapers on the morning of June 11th. He has not yet given the leadership of enormity of the problem demands. Because that starts to shake things up.
Right. What happens is, just as Martin Luther King is writing that, events take place in Birmingham, Alabama. And this is going to be so much a shape of what happens in the decade. The civil rights movement under Martin Luther King's leadership had organized a series of marches against segregation, and Birmingham, Alabama was one of those places. And this march on this particular day was called a children's crusade because it took a lot of young people marching peacefully just to talk about segregation. And Bull Connor, the sheriff there, set his dogs upon the marchers. High-powered hoses were thrown into them. They were forcing them against walls, hospitalizing some of them, arresting some of them. And it shocked the nation that such a thing had happened. And it shocked John Kennedy. And so on the very day that Martin Luther King is making this comment that he's moved too slowly and hasn't had a moral understanding of civil rights, he decided that day he was going to give a speech to the nation. And it was a really powerful speech. It was John Kennedy himself, really. He did it on television that night. Obviously, Sorensen had worked on it. But it was coming from him, finally. And he talked about civil rights as a moral problem. And he introduced then that he was going to introduce a civil rights bill to end segregation in the South. And that's the very bill that was going there through that summer, that was there through the March on Washington, that was there when John Kennedy died and had not yet made its way through the Congress, that Lyndon Johnson got through the Congress in his first year.
I read the chapter in the book, which I believe is chapter 6, Kaleidoscope, several times because it's so enormous. It's such an amazing chapter about so many enormous events. You start the chapter off by quoting Theodore Roosevelt, "Political affairs are kaleidoscopic." You keep coming back to that in the chapter during this time, and it just seems so fitting.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, just at the moment when so much seemed to be going well, I mean, after that civil rights bill was put into practice, into the halls of Congress, then Martin Luther King had the March on Washington in August of 63, which I was lucky to be at. In fact, Dick and I often measured the number of times we like to look back where we were at the same place at the same time, but we never met. Little wonder that we didn't meet at that march, because 250,000 other people were there as well as us. But for me, I was just an intern in the State Department. I was 20 years old. And it was an extraordinary day for me. I mean, I was carrying a sign, Catholics, Jews, and Protestants unite for civil rights. And I felt like I was part of something larger than myself, that feeling that really did signify that decade. And it was a great feeling that we were marching for a better America. Obviously, we listened to the great speech of I Have a Dream by Martin Luther King, but it was even more that collective sense that you were part of something. And I remember we all held hands and then sang We Shall Overcome, and I felt a sense of fulfillment that changed things for me, really. I went back to college that senior year, and I had gotten a Fulbright to go to Europe, and I decided not to take it. I wanted instead to go to graduate school and major in American politics and history.
Passed up my Fulbright too.
We could have met in Paris. Who knows? But anyway, I think what you're referring to, Joe, is the kaleidoscopic fair. It's not simply for me, but even more for my husband. He was just about to be appointed that day on November 22nd, a special assistant on the arts. Again, to be working with Jackie, he was going to be on the White House staff with a real project that he wanted to do. He loved literature and arts so much. And he was going to make arts, he thought. He told JFK it could be as important for him as conservation was for Teddy Roosevelt. And he had huge plans for bringing plays and theaters to rural areas where you wouldn't normally get them. It had leaked to the New York Times that he was going to be appointed this. So he had called down to Texas to talk to Kennedy, and it was decided that he actually should write his own announcement to be in the papers that day. So he was the man in the news in the New York Times that day of November 22nd saying that he was going to be appointed this. He was staying home in order to write that statement, called the White House with the statement at 2 in the afternoon, and the White House secretary said, "Oh my God, Mr. Goodman, haven't you heard the president's been shot?" And so his immediate instinct was to go to the White House. He had to be where everybody was. So he got involved in the small team that were preparing two things. They were preparing a room that Jackie wanted to have the East Room set up like it had been for Lincoln. They found out what that room looked like. Everybody took hands, putting crepe, putting a chandelier, getting the catafalque that was like Lincoln's, and it kept everybody busy. And then his second responsibility was to get the eternal flame that Jackie wanted so it could be at the gravesite so that, like, a little boy would always have a light to look at. Being there that night, I think, created even more that sense of Dick, that he was part of the family, of the Kennedy family. And this is when he begins to get to know Bobby. And this is when I would get mad, because Bobby was talking constantly. Bobby and LBJ hated each other. I mean, it was a visceral thing. It's so sad that it had to happen, but it happened. And I think part of it was that Bobby couldn't bear the idea of watching LBJ, as president in the place where his brother should have been. There's a moment when he's complaining that it's just not fair after LBJ was getting things done. My brother only had 3 years, and it was just not enough time. And so Dick tried to make him feel better by saying, well, Julius Caesar had only 3 years, and we remember him. And so he said, yeah, but it helps to have Shakespeare write about you, Bobby said, which was right. So at any rate, but in the journal entries that Dick kept, Bobby is saying, what does this guy, LBJ, know about hunger? What does he know about poor people? I said, he knows more than you do, I would say to Dick. So this was part of this whole argument. But anyway, eventually Dick does go and work for LBJ.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest is an unfinished love story, a personal history of the 1960s. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Hear part two of our conversation next time. Thanks to producer Sarah LaDuke. Thanks to Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com, and Universal Preservation Hall at uph.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.